Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hi, Ilona Thompson here with Palate Exposure. I'm here with a much anticipated interview. I've been looking forward to it so much, Chris. Chris Bentley. He and his wife Camille founded Bentley Heritage, and I had an opportunity to tour quite a few bits and pieces of the operation, which were immensely impressive and very intentional. So I'd like to ask you a little bit about your background first. I know your dad was a very prominent business person, absolutely brilliant, acumen to spare. So I know it started there. So if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about your background and your personal story.
Sure, yeah. Well, first of all, this site specifically, when I was a small boy, I would run around here and play. And I'd always thought this building was magic because it was historic. It is really a landmark here in the Carson Valley, if not Northern Nevada. And I always wanted something beautiful and special to happen to this building. And that might have been the first time that this project had a possibility of happening without even knowing what it was. I think at 8 years old, I didn't have my sights set on opening a distillery yet, but something lovely. And from there, I moved to San Francisco as an early teenager and was always struck, not just in San Francisco, but every place I would go, with historic, beautiful architecture. And so in my early 20s and 30s, I started to accumulate properties that were historic in nature and architecturally significant and restore those buildings. I really don't have much patience for a disposable society with strip malls and things that aren't meant to last. And we have these incredible buildings that really are just begging for a second or third chance, a new life. So that was part one of this property. Secondly was my wife and my fascination and love for Scotch whiskey. Oh. We love single malt Scotch whiskey, and we love Scotland, and we travel there quite frequently. We're married there. Oh. And really got into the history of it and the art of making it, and really wanted to create something here in the United States that was of equal character and quality. To our experience, we hadn't found that yet. Japanese single malt whiskeys, we're doing that at a beautiful level. There's some fantastic Japanese whiskeys out there. I actually discovered Japanese whiskey at a bar in Mexico City, which is kind of a fun adventure. And so we knew it could be done, and we wanted to do it properly. So we sort of merged the idea of this historic, the saving of this building and the restoration of it with putting a single malt whiskey distillery in the U.S. and making it a destination. So that is kind of the very early part of this as the brainchild for it.
So you had amazing bones. You had the land, you had the water rights, but building a distillery of world-class operation, it's a whole other undertaking. So I'm assuming you galvanized a lot of talent to help you achieve, to execute your vision.
Absolutely, yeah. I knew very little about the process of making single malt whiskey. I was more on the consumer end, and we definitely needed that expertise in hand. So we looked far and wide for some of the best people that we could and bring them on early as consultants and employees to help us really design this from the ground up. Mm-hmm. Camille and I, with our architecture firm, did it aesthetically, and we really used a winery more as a model, because wineries are beautiful places to go, and they have a great focus on visitors coming and having a whole experience, tours and tastings. And until very recently, that's not been how distilleries are run or certainly mm-hmm. built. So we wanted that, and we were successful in doing that only because of the incredible team that we were able to put together. And they've been, I think you met Johnny, our head distiller, mm-hmm. and Ryan, they've been with us from the day one and helped design this whole facility from a functional standpoint, and then implement that with the aesthetics that we wanted for it, both in the public house and also on the distilling floors, that, symmetrical piping and beautiful clear space, so that it was just very visually beautiful, as well as a state-of-the-art distillery.
I find it really interesting that Johnny, who's a master distiller, was a participant in the actual design of the space. I've always learned in the winery context, it's so important that the winemaker actually designs the cellar.
Yeah.
Because they get to work in it, and it has to be functional.
Yeah.
As well as aesthetic. So he was a key part making sure that everything flowed and kind of danced well together.
Yeah, he most certainly was. And we came to meet him because of his expertise and reputation in the industry, but once we met him, we gelled on a personal level. Mm. And he's just such a wonderful soul with a good heart, and he cares about all the right things. Mm. So we became fast friends, and he was very enthusiastic about the project, mm-hmm. and was part of designing it from the ground up, which has been great fun. And he's here today as our master distiller and an invaluable part of the team.
He used the word serendipity, and I feel that it's so fitting. Everything kind of came together.
Absolutely.
And you've scaled quite quickly in terms of equipment. I know you've been buying bigger and bigger pieces of beautiful machinery. They're just so sexy, I'm sorry, but
thank
still,
you.
Sir.
Well, it's supposed to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's deliberate. You really want to create an operation that's fully vertically integrated, but also the capacity that would allow you to produce all kinds of things, right?
Absolutely. Initially, this was only going to be a single malt whiskey distillery. Mm-hmm. That was our single vision. But as we got into the project, mm-hmm. After Johnny became involved, we decided that we also wanted to make other spirits. Mm-hmm. Because I enjoy gin very much. We wanted to make some liqueurs. And our vodka, Camille is a vodka drinker. But to do that, we wanted to do it at the same level as our whiskey, and we couldn't compromise anything. So we couldn't be making all these spirits on one still, which is what maybe a craft distillery might be doing. And we are not a craft distillery. Our scale, as you mentioned, is much larger than that. But we're also not one of the huge distilleries in the world or country. We're modest in that type of scale. So we set out to build basically a second distillery, which is over in the Creamery building. And those stills are all designed for a specific type of spirit, as mm-hmm. are our single malt whiskey stills, which were hand-forged copper from Scotland, from the Forsyth Company, fifth-generation copper workers, and just tremendous heritage and history there.
What is your artistic vision look like? I know you were inspired in Scotland. It was obviously delicious, and it really appealed to your palate. Mm. So when you set out to build your own brand, what was in your mind? What did you want to achieve?
It had to stand apart in every way possible, because distilleries are popping up right and left.
Indeed.
And unfortunately, a lot of them they're either on a shoestring budget, or they compromise something, quality in some way or another. And we knew to be successful, we couldn't compromise anything. Everything from the estate aspect of growing our own grains, choosing those grains, and processing them ourselves, to the distillation, the quality of the stills and the facility, and of course the people who run it. As whatever business you're in the people business, and you're only as good as your people. So we couldn't compromise on that. We wanted the best, and they also had to gel culturally and create a family, which we have here. Down to your final product, to your bottling. So we've designed all of our bottles custom so that they're beautiful, they stand out on the shelf, and the quality of the spirit inside reflects every aspect of that as well. So it's not just one thing or another. It's not just great packaging or just a great product or just a beautiful facility. It had to be all of that.
It seems to me that there's a lot of cohesion in the way you approach things and a lot of attention to detail, which are hallmarks of a very thoughtful approach as a business person. Tell me a little bit about where that came from.
It just came from the things in life or products that I appreciate myself. I'm a big Apple computer fan.
Oh.
And I love the thought that goes into a product that Apple designs. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful, it's elegant, it works, it's functional. And if you read about how that happened, there was tremendous thought put into that. Tesla cars, I mean, I could go on and on and on.
Yeah.
So basically, I took the example of other things out there in the world that I appreciate the design and thoughtfulness of, and tried to keep all of that in mind. And those are why those products are successful. I only know how to do things at the very best. I'm not the person to do something that might make a lot more money in the end, like a concrete tilt-up building in a field and just throw some stills in. I wouldn't know how to do that. And it wouldn't be fun at the end of the day. I want something that I can bring people in, the public, and show them and be very proud of.
So this is a really important value that you hold. You want to create value.
Yeah.
And value is not about the price. Value is really about what you receive as a result, experientially. Is that accurate? Is it something that...
Absolutely, yeah. When we built this, certainly our goal is for it to be a successful business, but that was not the first thought that we had, was to make money. Mm. The first thought we had was to make something of the best quality that we possibly could. And if you do that, then the business will follow. And we're not at the scale yet where we're attaining that. We will. We're just growing. We're just a year old now. But that is my philosophy. If you build it, they will come. And if you build it really properly, then they'll come and really appreciate it.
You know, it's good to know. It's good to know that the old adages hold just as much value today as they ever have. Especially when, like you mentioned, a crowded space and so much marketing language surrounding craft distilleries, which often can be confusing to the consumer because everyone is calling themselves artisans. Mm-hmm. Use the word sustainable, and very interchangeably. You're really an example of putting your mouth in the money, is so proverbially. It's very evident, even if you just touch a surface a little bit. In the case of an average person that may be able to come here and experience it, it becomes immediately apparent that this is something that's very, very important to you personally and to you as a leader of a brand.
Yeah.
And from the consumer perspective, when they see your product on the shelf, it's a very beautiful bottle, you guys obviously will see it. How do you want to be perceived? What do you want people to think about when they see a bottle of your spirits?
I want people to be fascinated by it, to be captivated. I want them to appreciate the physical artistry in the bottle, how it's presented. And then I want them to want to open it up and try it, because that's what it's all about at the end of the day. If you have a beautiful bottle and what's inside isn't worth it, then you're just wasting your time.
Yeah.
So we want to entice people in every way we have available, in appearance, in presentation, in our facility, to try our spirits, because we're working very hard to make them the best in the world.
How involved are you in the tasting aspect of it? Of course, you have a master distiller that makes key decisions, but when it comes to the palatal aspects, how engaged are you?
100%. I mean, that's the passion, right? So basically, we took a number of spirits already on the market that I personally enjoy very much, that I think are quality, they're doing it right, and we kind of use that as our benchmark. And we didn't set out to copy them, but we used them as an example. And we wanted our own characteristics and our own qualities to that same level.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we started. And then, like, for example, with our gin, we spent 3 years. We had a small R&D distillery for 4 years before this facility opened, where we did all of our flavor profiling and gin development, as well as some early barreling of some whiskeys to kind of see how things would go forward. And that was a really fun process, was putting together the botanical base and not just how scientific, but how fickle it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can have a whole botanical base in your gin that you're very happy with, and you just might want to bring one characteristic out or add a characteristic. You add a droplet in, the whole thing's destroyed. You have to start over. It's amazing. That was new to me. You know, Johnny certainly is familiar with that process, but it's been it's a matter of discovery for me, because again, I was no expert in the process before I set out, and I've learned so much in this process. And the more I learn, the more I realize I need to learn even more. It's a very complicated industry, but so much fun.
So there are certain categories that are so ardently pursued, if you will, gin, vodka, whiskey. You mentioned brandy as part of your future expansion plans. Is that somewhat undersung category, or are there others that you've identified that are really not pursued as much and that very interesting?
The brandy liqueurs. We actually have four liqueurs that we'll be releasing within the next 6 months.
Okay.
Two of them by January.
Oh, wow.
And they're beautiful liqueurs. So, again, we don't want to do too many things. We will definitely do some interesting products that might be distillery release only, mm-hmm. just to have some fun and play mad scientists in the still. But in terms of putting things to market, we don't want to dilute that. And mm-hmm. we want to do everything properly. And I feel if we do too many things, we could get in trouble there. So we're really just focusing on the gin, the vodka, and the whiskeys. Our liqueurs and brandy will be somewhat secondary, fun projects.
Okay. Speaking of whiskeys, to me there's a really important historical parallel, because some of the products that you'll be pursuing will not be drunk for decades to come.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been fascinated by that. You know, wines, of course, age, good wines age very well. But whiskeys is a whole other ballgame when it comes to aging.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Like, tell me about your perspective on it.
That always is hard for people to accept sometimes. We're making whiskeys today that I won't be able to drink in my lifetime.
There you go.
And that is our goal, actually. So yeah. We're making it for future generations. Now, we will have some that will be able to enjoy my lifetime, and I'm excited for that. We won't release a whiskey until it's ready. We won't rush it. That's the biggest mistake so many distilleries make, is they release something too young, and it's not ready. We'll never do that. But of course, we have a luxury not to do that. We want 20, 30, 40-year-old single malt whiskeys.
Wow.
And you have to be patient for that. So our 40-year whiskeys or 30-year whiskeys, probably more realistically, we call in-house, those are our deathbed whiskeys. When they're plugged into the machine, it's like, all right, now's the time. Break out a dram.
Wow. It must be fascinating to create something that someone else will enjoy so much that it's almost like paying forward. It's tapping into somebody's future and touching it.
Yeah.
Virtually.
Yeah. It really is. Toured many whiskey distilleries, most of them in Scotland, and
yeah.
met one of the head distilleries at one of my favorites over there. And he was so kind and humble, and he'd been working there for 40 years and moved his way up the ranks, and he's now master distiller. And he said the same thing. He's making whiskeys and has been for the last 10 years that he'll never be able to enjoy. Now maybe a little bit from the barrel. But in terms of the actual finished product, he won't be able to enjoy. And that made quite an impression on me. And he said that with a smile. I was very proud of that. He said, my children will enjoy it. My children's children will enjoy that. So when you're doing that, you're really talking about creating a legacy.
Yes.
And that's what this is. Not for myself, for my own name, but for the industry, and specifically the American whiskey industry. We're known very well for bourbons in this country, and we are making bourbon as well that we will be releasing in my lifetime. And they're wonderful. But in terms of the single malt whiskeys, it's a legacy for the industry and to really put something profound forward from the American effort.
We're a young country,
mm-hmm.
but we do have history.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something really interesting in the beginning of the conversation. Why aren't we embracing that history and highlighting it and showcasing it? Why are we rushing towards the newest and the shiniest?
Yeah.
And your life's work is very involved in that. Tell me, I know you love architecture, but where did it come from? Like the execution of what was in your mind?
I love history of all places, and I've done a lot of traveling through Europe and Asia, where they do have very long histories that are so impressive and fascinating.
Mm.
Yes, this country does have great history, and our Native American history goes just as far back as European histories, and
mm-hmm.
it's really wonderful, and it's something that's kind of glossed over, but it's always fascinated me. Like the name Bentley Heritage
mm-hmm.
Is not as simple as the heritage of my family, the mm-hmm. Bentley family, or even this property. It's the heritage of the industry and everything that goes around it. The heritage of Scotch whiskey, of Japanese whiskey, of American whiskey, and the tradition that goes along with that, and all the and for example, we have very traditional practices here in our distillation, and we have very modern practices, and we apply both wherever it seems best relevant. And it's kind of a fun combination of both. We do, we have auto malters at our malting facility. We also have floor malting, which is a very old practice and really not necessary, but the history and the heritage that that holds and the reason why and how it came to be that way, and actually the manual control that you have over that malt on the floor is something that I don't think should ever be lost. I think you should always tip your hat to the past and pay tribute to it and carry forward those things of value while also looking to the future and taking advantage of some technologies that can really help you as well.
You seem very anchored in that you really understand that history is that foundational piece that's really important to acknowledge and implement. There's practicality to it, but fundamentally what you describe is an homage to that. In your travels, what have been some of the most prominent experiences that influenced you, that kind of fed into that philosophy?
So many, gosh. Like,
I know, it's a difficult question, isn't it?
Everything from the beautiful temples and palaces that the Maharajas built in India that still stand today because they were built properly. The castles in Europe and Scotland, you know, these things weren't built for 10, 20 years. They were built to stand the test of time and wars. Mm. And they still are so beautiful and gorgeous. And there's not many buildings that we build with the same care and mindset to last into future generations.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.